Well, hello, this is the Trekkers Podcast. FYI, I'm your host, Doug, from Ontario, Canada, and welcome to the show. And do we have Mr. Ethan Brown here?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thank you so much for doing this, and I'd just like to add that you are my very first guest speaker here on the Trekkers Podcast, FYI.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me.
Yep, so you are an award-winning climate journalist, best known as the founder and host of the Sweaty Penguin Podcast, a PBS podcast combating climate anxiety and polarization. And your podcast has released 220-plus episodes. You have interviewed world-renowned experts from 18 countries, 6 continents, and you've earned a recognition at the Webby Awards and the Signal Awards, won first place in Boston University's New Venture Competition, and you inspired new geography courses at the University of Kansas that replaced their textbooks with podcasts. And also, your writing has been published in several outlets, including Newsweek, The Hill, The Orange County Register, and you've appeared on 80-plus podcasts and radio shows, TV shows. That is impressive.
Well, thank you. It's nice when you read it all out at once.
Yes, so just get it right out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, liberals and conservatives seem to hate each other. How can they find common ground on climate change?
Yeah, so that's a lot of the work that I do, is trying to first address the anxiety of this. I think we often think of climate anxiety as just the teenagers who are completely freaked out about their future, but I think there's a wide range there. I think it can come in the distrust that folks who may deny climate change or be skeptical of some of the alarmism may feel. I think it can be people who are just indifferent because they don't really know what's going on or want to process it or think about it. And it can be folks who feel a lot of the doom and gloom, which also is not entirely backed by science. There are a lot of possible solutions out there. So what I try to do is hit that first, and then from there start to talk about how there are policies across the political spectrum that can address these issues. It doesn't have to be all bans or regulations or things that may be unpopular. It can be very creative and innovative and cool and help not just the environment, but also the economy, health, justice, etc. So that's really why I love the work I do. And I find that in communicating in that way, it can reach both liberals and conservatives and start to find common ground.
Right. And it probably helps them, you know, understand a little bit more, maybe kind of help, you know, maybe relax them. So they don't have, you know, all this anxiety, especially you're talking about the younger people as teenagers, as they're trying to go through their high school, their college, and trying to get their life started. And we have all this happening around us.
Yeah, exactly. I think the Sweaty Penguin itself is largely targeted toward a college-age Gen Z type audience, just in the type of humor that we do. But I think that, yeah, I myself in high school felt a lot of climate anxiety. I was freaked out about my future, and that was why I got into it. I was never an outdoorsy person growing up. I have every seasonal allergy you can imagine and no hand-eye coordination. So I spent most of my time indoors, but it was that got me freaked out about climate change, but not necessarily interested in learning more. And it took taking some college classes for me to see it isn't just the doom and gloom headlines that are out there. There's a lot of nuance to these issues, a lot of critical thinking involved, and also a lot of solutions out there and a lot of progress that has already happened. And once I was able to shift my thinking there, I've become more and more hopeful every time I talk to a new person or do a new episode.
Yeah, now we've seen this in the past few years. Not just here in Canada, but across the United States and other parts around the world. We've seen record hurricanes, wildfires, heat waves, and other climate disasters. How do you find hope and optimism in all of that?
That's a good question. I think that, yes, the climate is absolutely changing. Those impacts are here right now. When people say, oh, climate change is about protecting the future for your kids and your grandkids, we're past that. It's here. We're seeing it. We're living it. Where I find hope is just because things are bad doesn't mean it's unlivable or that humans are going to go extinct or any extreme thing like that. And in fact, what we've seen over the last decade or so, the prices of solar, onshore wind, and batteries for electric vehicles have fallen by 85%, 55%, and 85% respectively. Here where I am in the US, our carbon emissions have come down about 20% since 2005, and 40% of our electric grid is decarbonized. And around the world, when the Paris Agreement was first signed in 2015, current policies projected that the world would warm by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, which is really bad. Today, that projection is down to about 2.7 degrees Celsius, just based on current policies. So that isn't as far down as we would like, but that's a pretty significant improvement to achieve in just a decade. And I think that seeing the way that the entire world is starting to recognize the issue, taking action for the issue. The energy sources that can help address it are becoming economically competitive and even economically beneficial. That's where I see hope. I think that we can absolutely address this.
Yeah, you know, here the Canadian government, and I think in the last 4 years, looking at too taxing citizens, it's a carbon tax, mm-hmm. and I guess it's in hopes that people will drive less, just be more conservative of what we're using and how we are using it, and so when it comes to for the political argument. The other parties are saying, oh, this is just a tax grab. We're just gouging Canadians. And the Prime Minister of Canada turns around and says, well, polluting isn't free.
Yep.
Right? So if the big corporations out there in the oil industry, in the gas industry, and they're getting this from the ground or wherever, and the pollutants are going in the air, yes, they have to pay so much money per million pieces of this stuff going into our air. So if it goes beyond that, they have to pay. And so that's what I say when it comes to, people discussing it. So on the other hand, the other parties are saying, well, no, this is just another tax grab. Canadians are taxed to death, the cost of living these days, so. But then coming back to this, to all the wildfires that we've had last summer in particular, was the most wildfires that I've seen here in Canada. We had over 800 fires burning.
Yeah.
And that was from the West Coast right through on into Quebec. And depending on the wind change, I live in Southern Ontario, it would come down through Southern Ontario and into the United States, and you can see the smoke in the air.
Oh yeah, my family lived it. Even up in Yellowknife, they had crazy wildfires last summer, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
But to the point of the carbon tax, I hate taxes as much as the next guy, but I think that what's unique and interesting about that type of policy is when you have a exchange in a market that has what's called a negative externality, which is where there are third parties who had nothing to do with that activity that are being impacted by it. So something like smoking cigarettes or, in this case, emitting carbon, then you can use a tax to sort of disincentivize that activity just enough to kind of balance out that negative cost. And They're obviously on paper and in practice are two different things, but in practice, I've seen that I think British Columbia had it for a little while, and there it actually led their, I think their GDP was growing at a higher rate than the other provinces in Canada when they implemented their carbon tax. So it wasn't crushing their economy by any means. And I guess my question with it is, how are we tracking the carbon emissions? Because carbon accounting is something that is very, very challenging. And I think the world is still kind of figuring out the best way to do it. But if executed right, and it can be structured in a lot of ways, it's not, it doesn't have to be a tax grab. That money can be paid back in dividends to individuals. It can be used to reduce income taxes. It can be used to do environmental cleanups. It can go back to the people in some way. So yeah, I think there's a lot of creative ways to do it, but certainly it's good that it's been shown to work in some cases.
Yeah. With the financial aspect to it, with it too, is that the Canadian government, they actually issue checks, I think it's three times a year back to Canadians.
Which is awesome because it gives you the choice, right? You can make money by doing nothing, or you can live your current lifestyle and you pay the tax on the carbon instead of on your incomes. Like it really, I think that a policy like that genuinely gives people the freedom to do what they want to do, and even a reward if you have the desired behavior. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So how do you make climate change funny? And is it funny on its own in any ways?
I think that what we try to look for, and I think we do it differently than other folks who have tried to combine climate and comedy. I see a lot of comedians and even movies like Don't Look Up, where they just try to be like, oh, haha, the world's going to end. And it's not that funny to me, to be honest, or just like going after certain companies or CEOs or individuals. What I've always tried to do with The Sweaty Penguin is look for, this is called the incongruity theory of comedy, basically looking for weird combinations of things that you wouldn't expect. Just trying to think of an example off the top of my head. We did an episode on succulents, and succulents are certainly impacted by climate change and other environmental issues. But what's happened is the succulents that are now endangered are being sold on the black market as rare succulents for like $1,000. And people think that they're rescuing these rare succulents and saving them from environmental damage, where in reality, they're just preventing them from spreading their seeds and making the problem worse. So I found there was a case in, I think it was in New Zealand, where there was a woman who had like tried to get through airport security with like 900 succulent seeds, like taped to her body with stockings, and got caught. But just the fact that that incident would happen is so bizarre and funny to me. But it's looking for those types of stories, right? Where you see climate change leading to just these absolutely bizarre situations, or a bizarre situation that creates a bit of damage, or in solutions looking for things like when companies find ways to turn atmospheric carbon into whiskey. Like, that's hilarious to me. So there's a lot of
anything like that.
Yeah,
I've never heard anything like that, like taking that turning it into whiskey and stuff like that. That'd be interesting.
Yeah, there's some pretty interesting startups out there.
Yeah, so how do you approach a conversation with someone you disagree with politically, and why even bother?
I think that it first takes a lot of patience, and it takes not wanting to convince the person, but more so just wanting to learn their perspective and learn why they feel the way they feel. I think that's how I've always approached these conversations. I grew up in a town that is kind of 50-50 liberal conservative, and so I was always very open to hearing everyone's perspectives and how they came to them. And I think that's largely what has informed me today, where I can then talk about climate change to liberals and conservatives and find success in that messaging. But yeah, it really starts with just listening to them, asking them questions, learning how they feel what they feel, and then looking for common ground. I think that even if someone is completely a climate denier or a climate doomer and there's no moving them on that, maybe they care about their pocketbooks or their health or their hobbies, or maybe you have a sports team you like in common or a movie you both like. Just finding those connections can really help make those conversations a lot more friendly, a lot more fruitful. And from there, yeah, just kind of seeing how you can move the needle based on those things you have in common. I think climate solutions have the opportunity to help literally everything we care about. We so often talk about them as trade-offs between the environment and the economy, or trade-offs between the environment and justice or what have you, but they're not trade-offs oftentimes. They can be if you make really stupid policy, but if you're smart about it and you craft things creatively, you can absolutely address all these things at once. And so being able to then propose those solutions and say, hey, what do you think about this idea? It would help what you care about and what I care about. That's where I start to really find success.
Yeah. Do you ever, like, so in that perspective, going in that direction and talking to somebody about it, and have you ever found it even sometimes that, you know, they just are just stuck into what they believe and they don't really want to make that change or even come to some sort of an agreement?
It happens occasionally, I would say. It's a little more likely if I'm doing a interview and there's a person who has to cater to their audience, and so I'm not gonna get them to change their mind on air. But just talking to people, and honestly most of the time I do interviews as well, I find that we're all human. We all want to learn new things and find hope for the future. And for myself, it's just building that trust and showing that I'm open-minded too. I'm willing to change my mind on things too. And whenever I get fed something that is true, I'll acknowledge that. Like if someone says, hasn't the climate changed for thousands of years? Absolutely it has. That's very true. And here's why that happened. And here's why it's different today. So that's just kind of an example. But I think that there's absolutely those opportunities to strike that common ground. And then from there, I find that people are much more open to maybe shifting their perspective, or at the very least, I get to learn why they feel the way they feel. And that helps me.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Cause myself, I mean, I believe there's something amiss. And by saying that, this past winter that we've had here in Southern Ontario, can't speak for, I'll speak a little bit for the other provinces, stuff like that. It was an unprecedented record, I guess, above normal temperatures. And here in Southern Ontario, we had little to no snow, whereas growing up as a kid, I can't even count the number of snow days that we had that we didn't go to school.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we shoveled the driveway twice the entire winter.
Wow.
That's it. You know, so that's, to me, is saying, okay, you know, we've been above normal temperatures back in January. March. So February, when it was still winter, we had a balmy day of 22 Celsius.
Oh, wow.
you know, and we had a couple of those days like that throughout February. And I don't ever recall in my lifetime that we had weather like that in February, and you know, even early March when we would have our March break and schools out, we would still have plenty of snow. And right now we're not seeing this, but like I say, it varied across Canada. And I know out on the eastern provinces, like St. John's, Newfoundland Land and all that, 3 weeks ago or something like that, they got something, they get almost 3.5 feet of snow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then like the western provinces, it's generally colder when you get into Alberta and places like that, but they did have some cold, but they had a lot more snow than we did here in Southern Ontario. We had basically nothing. Like I said, when they were calling for a lot of snow, we were going to get a foot, maybe a foot and a half. We got maybe 3 inches.
Yeah.
You know, and then it was gone.
Yeah. And so, you, this is an important point, right? Because climate and weather are two very different things. But they're different. We're not saying that just because the global temperature goes up by 1.5 degrees Celsius, that means every day is going to be 1.5 degrees Celsius hotter. We're going to have hotter hot days, colder cold days, stronger storms, but it completely varies depending on a large number of factors. Something that impacts our winters in Canada and the United States is the behavior of the polar jet stream. And the North Pole and the Arctic is warming at the fastest rate in the world. So it's warming faster than where we are in the relatively southern latitudes. And that's because the sea ice up there, as it melts, it goes from a white color, which is reflecting back sunlight, to now it's suddenly a darker color and it's absorbing sunlight. So that creates this kind of more suction of heat that warms that area faster. And that means the difference in temperature between the Arctic and where we are is less, which then causes the polar jet stream that separates that air from our air to start to buckle. And so that's why we see those days where like Texas gets snow and a cold wave. But then we also see if it doesn't buckle, then you have in Southern Ontario a warmer than usual winter. So it can really vary, and climate change factors into all of it, but it's never consistent. And that's maybe where sometimes people can get confused.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Cause like even with the Great Lakes, I haven't seen them freeze over, you know, in a very long time. And they generally do, like coming January, February, when it's supposed to be really cold out, and that the lakes are frozen.
Yeah. And you can have 1 year where they get the worst cold wave in history for a week, but then the rest of winter is a little warm, or it's just a warm winter. You never know.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess that has to do with what you were talking about there too, with the ice shield, how the sun is reflecting off it, and it's like, it's not that blue that you would see that would be saying that, yeah, that's cold, but it's darker. So there, you know, it's warming.
Yeah. It's the same way. Like if you go out on a sunny summer day wearing a black shirt, you're going to be a lot hotter than if you wore a white shirt. It's really the same thing. And that can not only impact the way that the Arctic warms, but it leads to this snowball effect where basically as it's getting darker, it's sucking up more heat, which then causes it to warm more. And it can kind of start to self-perpetuate the warming, which is certainly not something we want to see.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Can individuals do anything to stop climate change themselves?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a good debate about whether the responsibility falls on individuals or on corporations or on governments. And I think it's in all of the above. I don't think any one group can do everything at once. But what individuals can do, what I think is most important, is finding ways where you can impact community level change. So For some, that may be voting, that may be activism, that may be advocacy. But for me, I never could see myself as an activist. I hate crowds. I could never put something on a sign and feel good about it because I just love the nuance and getting into all the specifics. But I loved writing. So I started writing, and that led to podcasting, and that led to doing media interviews like this. But that was where I found I could have my voice. For others, that may be advocacy in the workplace. I did a news article on thesweatypenguin.com last month about how there are several just standard employees at companies. I was talking about a paralegal at Microsoft that I heard from in a webinar who just decided to partner up with ocean cleanup at a Microsoft hackathon, which led to a project that that identified waste in like 10,000 photos of river waste they had cleaned up, which then led him to co-found an employee advocacy group at Microsoft that's now 10,000 people and helped shift the company toward zero carbon, zero waste goals. So you can really have an impact just as an individual by just seeing where you are and what you can do and going for it. Beyond that, I always say the most important thing is to talk to someone you disagree with. Like we talked about earlier, it's such a beneficial way to learn where other people come from, get more voices influencing your perspective, and ultimately find common ground on climate solutions. The more people who have their voices heard, the better all these solutions will be.
Yeah. So in perspective, stopping climate change, would that require us also to change our diets?
Yes and no, but I'd lean no. I think that, yes, there is a higher environmental impact to eating meat versus eating plant-based foods. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Some are inherent, some are based on just the way that we produce these products. But there are also solutions besides us stopping eating those foods. That said, if someone does go vegan, I cheer them on. I don't make fun of them. I think that's awesome. And but I personally have not made that choice for both preference and also allergy reasons. So there's plenty of options. But yeah, for agriculture, it's not just what we eat. It's also how we produce it. So I interviewed an expert on our podcast, for example, who has developed these seaweed additives to cattle feed that change the methane reaction in their stomach and makes it so they don't belch methane anymore. That has a huge impact, and that brings down the environmental impact of beef and allows people to continue eating it. So there's a lot of things out there like that that, if they can be widely adopted, it can really bring down the environmental impact of agriculture and allow people to eat what we want to eat.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right too. Yeah. Because I mean, the whole world isn't going to turn vegan.
No,
no, we're not going to see that happen, you know? So, like I've changed my diet considerably too, right? I tend to eat more plant-based. You know, I guess you could say, like, I'm not 100% vegan. You know, I'm a flexitarian, you know, so I still do eat the animal meat products, but in a smaller, in a meal that if I was going to have red meat, it would be no bigger than a bar of soap.
Yeah, and you that's know, fantastic.
And yeah, the rest of my stuff is fruit and vegetables and other beans and other iron nutrients stuff, right?
Yeah, I think I saw something like the average American eats 3 hamburgers a week or something. And if you drop one of those, you make a pretty significant dent. You don't have to go all the way. No. But that said, I also hope that we pursue those systematic solutions too that can just address it across the board, and we can continue growing the foods we love sustainably and continue to enjoy them.
Yeah. Meatless Mondays.
There you go. It works. It does.
Sure. What episode of The Sweaty Penguin most surprised you, and which one would you recommend to first-time listeners?
Oh my gosh, it's hard to pick from all your children. I think the one that I would recommend is a very recent one called Rethinking Carbon, where we interviewed Dr. Michael Mann, who, if you haven't heard of, he's perhaps the most famous climate scientist in the world. But we talked about a very hopeful thing, which is, for the longest time, I had understood this concept called the carbon lag, which is basically when humans stop emitting carbon dioxide or we become carbon neutral, there's still all the carbon that we've already emitted in the atmosphere. And carbon has a lifespan of over 100 years. So all of it's just living up in the atmosphere, continuing to absorb infrared radiation. And as such, I understood it as we would continue to see the climate warm for decades after we finished cutting carbon emissions. And that was a big concern to me, like not just as a human, but also as a communicator. How do you express this to people when we do all the work and we still see warming? What Michael Mann introduced to me and what we ended up talking about is, that is actually not quite accurate. Yes, that effect happens, but at the same time, we have oceans and other carbon sinks around the world that suck carbon out of the atmosphere, and in doing so have a cooling effect. And that warming effect and that cooling effect essentially cancel each other out, and the climate would stabilize in just a few years after we stop emitting carbon. So that's actually very good news. That means there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We can see this issue addressed within our lifetimes. And that got me very excited and very motivated. And so I encourage anyone to listen to that just for the sake of hearing some of that good news from one of the most prolific climate scientists in the world. As for most surprising, I think I would have to go back to our vanilla episode, which is very old, but very mind-blowing to me. There was a point in 2017 where the price of vanilla was higher than the price of silver. And there were a few reasons. First off, I think 80% of the world's vanilla is grown in Madagascar. There was a cyclone that hit Madagascar that year and wiped out a whole bunch of the vanilla crop. But then there's also an issue where it takes about 4 years, I think, from when vanilla is grown to when it can be harvested and sold. It's a very delicate process, and that means that farmers are having to predict demand far in advance, which is just a futile task. And if you get it wrong, that means prices can plummet or prices can spike. And in those boom years, we see a lot of farmers come into all this wealth that they don't know what to do with. There aren't banks in rural Madagascar, and there's a lot of crime there. And so you see farmers just trying to get rid of the money in any way they can, buying sports cars, buying just using the money as quickly as possible. And then obviously the bust years are even worse. So I found that episode very interesting and very surprising.
Yeah, well, that's really surprising too. That's very interesting. Climate change is often framed as environment versus economy, where helping one hurts the other. You push back on the framing in episodes of The Sweaty Penguin. Why is that?
Yeah, I find every environmental issue also has an economic impact. It goes, you have to dig deeper than just, oh, well, this company is making a profit. Usually the economy as a whole is hurting when there's an environmental issue. First off, you can just think of the obvious, right? When you have a big hurricane or wildfire or heat wave, you're damaging infrastructure, you're creating healthcare costs, you're creating lower productivity, and you have to pay for the cleanup. But then beyond that, I find that a lot of the fossil fuel technologies like oil and natural gas are not just less economically competitive than they used to be as compared to clean energy, but they're much more volatile with their pricing, similar to that vanilla thing we were just talking about. So that can lead to that time in COVID when I think oil prices got negative for a second there. It can also lead to what happened last year where gas prices are through the roof and continue to be through the roof. And so having that versus if you set up a solar farm, you set up a wind farm, it's going to produce about the same amount of energy all the time until it's at the end of its life. So you don't really have to worry about that, which is helpful for the economy. There's examples like that that we can go through with essentially every environmental issue. On the flip side with solutions, we see that a lot of climate solutions actually lead to us saving money. It's not just clean energy. It's also a lot of clean transportation things like public transit or biking or walking. It's certain things with agriculture and forests. And there's a long list, but we see these solutions save money and also help a lot of the other issues we care about. So that's why I get excited to work on climate and pursue these solutions. And I hope it can bring more people into the climate conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, because when I was thinking about, you know, having guests on my podcast and, you know, where could I start? And there's two places that I could start at. One was on health and wellness, and the other one would be environment, you know, because actually I think those two go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought, okay, well, let's start with the environment one, and then hopefully move on from that. So having you on this show is like I say, this is fantastic.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you having me, and I'm glad we could cover this topic. It's very important and very interesting and hopeful when you really get into the weeds.
Yeah. So most people think of figures in the Gen Z climate movement as activists at protests, making massive demands on politicians, but you've taken a very different route, becoming the informer and not demanding anything of anyone. And why did you choose that niche for yourself?
I think I found as I got into the space that there were a lot of policy ideas that could address any given issue. And each one had its pros and its cons, and very rarely did I ever find myself saying, oh, that's the right answer. It was always, yeah, if we do any one of these, if people agree on it, I'm game. So it became very hard for me to get into advocacy work because we'd be advocating a specific policy and I'm like, okay, but that's one option. What about this one or this one or this? And that's not really that work. So what I think I do best is laying out all the options, laying out the pros and cons, and then letting people talk and let them figure out what they like best. Ultimately, I feel that the best climate solutions are the ones that everybody agrees on. It's not one party has to fight to get it through the other party and ram it down people's throats and then hold a slight majority in government to not get it overturned. This is a long transition. This takes decades. And mm-hmm. It's better to have one plan in place that we all like and we can stick to and we get this done. So that's really why I think I'm better suited to just inform, to share all the options, to help cultivate hope, cultivate common ground, and then let other folks do the policy work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly right. You know, especially you're in your early 20s, and so you know you're probably, you know, you can, I guess, just reach out to people in your age group from your era and probably help them also better understand what's taking place. Us older guys, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, most certain there's something is happening, you know, and it's not good. And like say there, that we can make change, but then people my age are, you know, are on the other end of the spectrum saying that, you know, climate change doesn't exist. You know, this is just a natural process what the planet is going through.
Yeah, there's folks on either end of the spectrum. There's folks who deny climate change is happening or that it's human caused or that it's important. And then there's also plenty of folks my age who think we're all going to die on Thursday. And it's about finding that happy medium. Yes, we know climate change is happening. We know it's human caused. We know it's bad. We know we can fix it too. And scientists have confirmed this. And so really bringing everyone into that space where we can be constructive and say, I hear your concerns. I hear your concerns. Let's find something that works for everybody. That's the kind of space that I try to make with my work.
Yeah, for sure. So how did you come up with the name The Sweaty Penguin?
So my dad was the one who thought of the name, actually. We were just trying to think of a funny, cute name that encompassed climate and comedy. And he always says, I'm free to use the name for whatever I need. Just be sure to credit him whenever you get asked that question. So there you go.
Yeah, there you go. So ladies and gentlemen, the listeners on the show here too, check out the Sweaty Penguin podcast. I'm sure you can get that wherever you get your podcast. And this was great. I'm just so honored that we were able to set this up and for you to come on the Truckers Podcast. Like I said, you are my very first guest speaker. I've been doing the podcast 5 years now, and I'm just
wow.
A solo host, you know, doing my own thing and, you know, stuff like that. And I thought, you know, I gotta, you know, kind of just make some change and stuff like that. If I want to talk about something, I like to have a guest on the show who is familiar with that topic, like yourself.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the invite. I'm honored to join you and happy to do it again anytime.
Yep. Well, I'll tell you what, you know how to contact me if there's something that comes up that you may want to discuss, and give me some heads up, and I'll be more happy to welcome you back here on the Truckers Podcast, FYI, for sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it sure was. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is the show for today. Happy Easter to everybody. Thank you to Mr. Ethan Brown for doing this. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and your week coming up until next Saturday, Sunday, when we meet again here in the Truckers Podcast. Be safe and take care, and thank you.